turning up. Must have been the best thing that had happened to him in years. Life must be shit with no friends, and always worrying about being hit. But that was how mine was going to be if I didn't get this stuff back to Simmons. Big Al used the room phone to call a car hire company. It would take about an hour to deliver a vehicle, so the three of us strolled to an ATM. He drew out $1,200 from four different accounts.
You never know when you're going to need mucho dinero in a hurry.
He grinned. Maybe he wasn't so stupid after all. Back in the room, waiting for the car, I could sense there was more to come from him. He'd definitely been brooding on something for the last half hour.
Would you like to make some money, Nicky? Real money?
I was checking my bag to make sure I hadn't left anything.
Why's that? Are you going to give me some? Sorta.
He came and stood by me as I zipped the bag closed.
On those files, there are some account numbers stuffed with lovely narco dollars. Give me 2 minutes to access the stuff I need, and then I can hack in. I can do that shit in my sleep.
He put an arm round me.
Nick, 2 minutes on my laptop, and we could be talking serious enrichment. What do you think?
His head was nodding at 1,000 RPM, his eyes never leaving mine. I let him sweat a bit.
How do I know that you'll pay me my half?
I thought I'd let him know how much I wanted.
I can transfer it anywhere you want. And don't worry, once I moved it, they'll never know where it's gone.
I had to smile. The one thing Frank DiSabatino was good at was hiding money.
Come on, Nicky Two. What do you say?
He had his arms wide open and was looking at me like a child who'd done wrong. I gave him the time he needed with the laptop and wrote down the account number for him to transfer my share to. Fuck it. Kelly was going to need money for school and stuff. And I wanted a payback for working against these people for so many years. It felt good. And anyway, it was just business. He finished. There was a serious, down-to-work look on his face.
Where are you going now?
He asked.
I'm not going to tell you. You know the score.
People that I've been in contact with are now dead, and I don't want that to happen to you.
Bullshit.
He looked at Kelly and shrugged his shoulders.
You just don't want me to know, in case I go blurting after somebody.
That's not the case, I said, though in fact it was. If you did that, or didn't send the money, you know what I'd do. He raised an eyebrow. I looked at him and smiled.
I'd make sure the right people know where you are.
The color drained from his face for a while, then back came the watermelon. He shook his head.
I may have been out of the loop for a while, but I see nothing has changed.
The telephone rang. The blue Nissan was waiting outside reception. Big Al signed for it and gave me the customer copy of the agreement for when I'd dropped it off. Kelly and I got in. Big Al stayed on the sidewalk with his briefcase. I pressed the switch to open the windows. The bass rap still played in the background.
Listen, Al, I'll email you to make sure you know where the car's been dropped off, okay?
He nodded slowly. It was sinking in that he was about to lose us.
Do you want a lift anywhere? No, I got work to do. By the morning, we could be rich, big time.
We shook hands through the open window. Al smiled at Kelly and said,
Make sure you come and visit Uncle Al in about 10 years' time, little lady. I'll buy the ice cream.
We set off slowly down the strip. It was still packed. There was so much neon the street lighting was superfluous. Kelly was in the back, staring out of the window, then gazing into space, lost in our own little world. I didn't tell her that ahead of us lay a 700-mile drive. Soon Daytona was behind us, and we were back on the long open road. As I drove, I mulled over Kev's words again. You won't believe the stuff I've got here. Your friends over the water are busy. And it also said, I've just started the ball rolling on something, but I'd be interested to know what you think. Did that mean he'd spoken to his boss? Had his boss then got him zapped? But there was no way Kev would have been talking to anyone in the DEA if he suspected corruption. So, who the fuck did he call? I had some valuable stuff from the pirate office, a lot of which I didn't understand. But maybe Kev had more. The more information I got hold of, the better it was going to be for me when I got it back to Simmons. And that was why we were going back to Washington. Once on the interstate, I put the car onto cruise control and my mind into neutral. We drove through the night, stopping only to refuel and for a caffeine fix to keep me awake at the wheel. I bought cans of Coke to keep the levels topped up as we drove and in case Kelly woke up. At first light, I could begin to make out changes in the terrain, proof that we were moving north into a more temperate climate. Then the sun came up, a big burning ball in my half-right position, and my eyes started to sting. We stopped at another gas station to fill up. This time Kelly stirred.
Where are we? She yawned.
I don't know.
Well, where are we going?
It's a surprise.
Tell me about your wife, she said.
It seems so long ago I can hardly remember. I looked in the mirror. She'd slumped back down, too tired to pursue it. Or maybe she was suffering from terminal boredom. And who could blame her? I wanted to have one hit on Kev's, to see what he had, and I wanted to make entry at last light tonight. I knew there'd be a secure area somewhere in the house, exactly where we'd have to find out. After that, I wanted to be out of the Washington area again before first light. Big Al didn't know it yet, but he was going to get his ass into gear and help us out of the U.S. If he didn't do it voluntarily, I'd be giving him a bump start. By mid-morning, Kelly was wide awake, reading a magazine I'd got her at the last stop. She was lying in the back, shoes off, totally absorbed. We hadn't talked. We were in a world of empty sweet wrappers, polystyrene coffee cups, crisp packets and bottles of Coke with bits of crisp floating in them. Kelly?
Hmm?
You know, in your house, Daddy had a hidey hole for you and Ida.
Yeah?
Well, do you know if Daddy had any hidey holes for important things like money? Or where Mummy would keep her rings? Did he have a special place where they'd put stuff?
Sure, yeah. Daddy's got his own special place.
Busying myself with the cruise control, I said, Oh? And where is that then?
In his den.
Which made sense. But that was the room that had been well fucked over. Where is it exactly?
In the wall.
Whereabouts?
In the wall. I saw Daddy doing it once. We're not allowed in there, but the door was open, and we'd just come in from school, and we saw Daddy putting something in there. We were standing right by the door, and he didn't know.
Is it behind the picture? I asked, though there was no way he'd be that bone.
No, it's behind the wood.
The wood?
The wood.
Could you show me?
Is that where we're going?
She suddenly sat bolt upright.
I want Jenny and Ricky.
We can't see them when we get there because they'll be busy. She looked at me as if I was mad.
They're my teddies, I've told you. They're in my bedroom. Can't I get them? They need me.
I felt a right dickhead. Of course you can, so long as you're quiet. I knew there was more to come.
Can I see Melissa and tell her sorry that I missed a sleepover?
We won't have time. She sat back into her seat, brooding.
But you're going to phone her mommy.
I nodded. I started to see signs for Washington. We'd been on the road for nearly 18 hours. My eyes were smarting worse than ever, despite the air conditioner being on full blast. We'd get there in 2 hours, but there'd still be a few hours to kill before last light. I pulled in at a rest area and tried to sleep. It would be a busy night. Kelly was in the back doing her own thing in a sea of stale food, sweat, and my farts. It was about 6 in the evening as we approached the Lawton turnoff. For once, it wasn't raining, just overcast. Only about 45 minutes to go. I couldn't see Kelly in the mirror. She was hunkered down in the seat again. Are you awake?
I'm tired, Nick. Are we there yet?
I'm not going to tell you. It's going to be a surprise. Just keep down. I don't want you to sit up. I drive into the estates and onto Hunting Bear Path. Negotiating the speed bumps ultra-cautiously so I could have a good look around. Everything looked quite normal. I could see the back of Kev's garage, but I couldn't see the front of the house yet. When I got up level, the driveway was finally exposed. Parked up outside the front door was a blue and white. No problem. Just look ahead, act normal. I drove on, checking in the rearview mirror. The side lights were on and it was 2 up. They were basically just there to keep rubberneckers away. The house hadn't been boarded up yet, but it was still cordoned off with yellow tape. I drove straight on. I couldn't tell if they were looking at me. Even if they did a plate check as I drove past, it wouldn't matter. They'd only come up with Big Al. If I was compromised, I'd run for it and leave Kelly here. Maybe the uniformed police would be good guys and look after her. At least, that would be the logical thing to do. But there was a conflict. I'd promised that I wouldn't leave her. That promise shouldn't mean much, but it did. I went down to the bottom of the road and turned right, to get out of sight as quickly as possible, then drove a big square to get back in behind them. I reached the small parade of shops. The car park was about a quarter full, so we could pull in without attracting attention. Kelly shrieked,
"We're at the stores!"
"That's right. But we can't buy anything because I haven't much money left. But we can go to the house."
"Yes! Can I get my Polly Pockets and Yak Bags from my bedroom, too?"
"Of course you can." I didn't have a clue what she was on about. I went round to the back, opened up the boots and got out the bag, then opened her door. I threw the bag in beside her and leaned in.
"Are we going to my house now?"
I started to sort out the kit I'd been needing. "Yes. I want you to help me because I want you to show me Daddy's hidey hole. Can you do that? It's important. He wanted me to check something. We've got to sneak in because there's police outside. Are you going to do everything that I say?"
"Yeah, I'll do that. Can I get Pocahontas as well?"
"Yep." I didn't give a fuck. I'd have nodded and agreed to anything so long as she showed me the cash. "You ready? Let's put your hood up." It was dark and cloudy, and thankfully the road wasn't exactly built for pedestrians. We shouldn't encounter any Melissas en route. With the bag slung over my shoulder, I held her hand and we set off towards the house. It was nearly 7 o'clock and the street lights were on. My plan was to work our way to the back of the house, so I could stand off, have a look at it, and prepare to make entry. We started to walk over the waste ground to the rear of the house, past porter cabins and stockpiles of girders and building materials. The mud was so treacherous in places, I thought we'd lose our shoes. She was almost beside herself with excitement, but fighting it hard.
"That's where my friend Candice lives."
She pointed to a house.
"I helped her with their yard sale. We got $20.
"Shh." Smiling, I said slowly, "We've got to be very, very quiet, or the policeman will get us." There was a look of confusion on her face.
"Nick?"
"What now?" "Yes, Kelly."
"Why are we hiding from the police? Aren't they good guys?"
I suppose I should have anticipated that one. What could I say? She wouldn't have understood any of the 100 reasons why we've been up to our necks in shit if the police caught us. Even if I did have a spare couple of hours to explain them to her. Nor did I want to undermine forever her confidence in the authorities at this early stage in her life. So I lied. I don't think they're real cops. I think they're just dressed up like cops. They might be friends of the men who came to see Daddy. It didn't take long for that to register. Finally, we were standing in the shadow of the neighbor's garage. I put the bag down and watched and listened. The engine of the blue and white was ticking over. They were less than 20 meters away on the other side of the target. I could hear a little of their radio traffic, but couldn't make out what was being said. Now and again a car drove past, braked for the speed bumps, rattled over and accelerated away. Lights were on in some of the houses, and I could see into the rooms. It had always given me a strange sort of kick doing this, like my own private viewing of a David Attenborough documentary. Human beings in their natural habitat. As a young soldier in the late 70s in Northern Ireland, part of our job was to lurk. Hang around in the shadows, watching and listening, hoping to catch a glimpse of someone with a weapon. It was amazing what you'd see people doing in their cars or front rooms, and slightly less amazing what they'd be up to in their bedrooms. Sometimes we'd watch for hours on end, all in the line of duty. I really enjoyed it. Here, people were just doing their washing up or watching TV, and probably worrying about the effect of multiple murders on real estate prices. There were no proximity lights at the back of the house, just standard ones with an on-off by the patio doors. I remembered switching them on for a barbecue. I stroked Kelly's hair and looked down and smiled. Then slowly and quietly, I unzipped the bag and got out what I needed. I put my mouth right to her ear and whispered, "I want you to stay here. It's really important that you look after this kit. You'll see me over there, okay?" She nodded. Off I went. I reached the patio doors. First things first, make sure they're locked. They were. I got my mag lights and checked to see if there were any bolts at the top and bottom of the frame. It's no good defeating a lock if there are also bolts across, and that's one of the reasons why you try to attack a building at the point of last exit, because you know they can't have bolted up again from the outside. Normally, the next thing to do would be to look for the spare key. Why spend an hour with a lock-picking kit if there's one hidden only feet away? Some people still leave theirs dangling on a string just the other side of the letterbox, or on the inside of a cat flap. Others leave it under a dustbin or just behind a little pile of rocks by the door. If there's a lamppost in the garden, it always pays to feel around the base because it's a natural marker. If a key is going to be left, it will nearly always be somewhere on the normal approach to the door. But this was Kev's house. I wouldn't find spare keys lying around. I put the photographer's blanket over my head and shoulders and, with the maglight in my mouth, got to work with a lockpick gun. It didn't take long. I opened the doors gently, moved the curtain aside and looked inside the living room. The first thing I noticed was that all the other curtains and shutters were closed, which was good for me because once inside we'd have cover. The second thing that hit me was an overpowering smell of chemicals. Chapter 34. I tiptoed back to Kelly and whispered, "Come on then." Our shoes were caked with mud, so we took them off on the concrete terrace and put them in the bag. Then we stepped inside and I pulled the doors closed. I held the mag lights with my middle finger and forefinger over the lens to contain most of the light, and kept it close to the floor so we could see our way through the living room. The carpet and underlay had been taken up, and all the furniture was pushed to one side. All that was left were the chipboard sheets that the builders had used instead of floorboards. Someone had done a good job of scrubbing the bloodstains where Kev had been lying, which explained the chemical smell. The murder mop people had been in. Once forensics finished, it was up to the commercial companies to clear away the mess. We reached the door that led into the front hall. Kelly stood still, an old hand at this stuff now. I got on my knees, eased it ajar, and looked through. The front door was closed, but light from the street lamps shone through the stained glass flower set into the window above it. I switched off the torch and stationed Kelly by the bag in the hallway. I stopped and listened and generally tuned in. The engine was still idling. I felt Kelly pulling my jacket.
Nick!
Shh!
Where's the carpet gone? And what's that horrible smell?
I turned round and half crouched down. I put my finger on her lips again and said,
"We'll talk about it later."
There was a beep, beep, beep from the blue and white's radio. The guys inside were probably drinking coffee, pissed off to be on guard duty all night. Some radio traffic came on the net. Whoever was controlled sounded like Hitler with a dress on. She was giving somebody a bollocking. Indicating that Kelly should stay where she was, I moved across to the study and gently opened the door. I went back, picked up the bag and guided Kelly into the room, propping the door open with the bag to let the light come through from the hall. Everything looked very much the same as before, except that the stuff that had been strewn all over the place had now been arranged in a neat line along one wall. The PC was still on its side on the desk, the printer and scanner in position on the floor. They had all been dusted for prints. I took the photographer's material and a box of board pins from the bag and lifted the chair near to the window. Taking my time, I climbed up and pinned the fabric along the top and down the sides of the entire wooden window frame. I could now close the door and put on the torch, taking care not to shine it in my face. I didn't want to scare her. I'd done a job once, which involved getting a mother and her child out of the Yemen, and the child went apeshit because we were working with torches in our mouths, and it made us look like the devil at work. I felt quite pleased with myself for remembering this and sparing Kelly. Maybe I knew something about kids after all. I went over to her. Even above the reek of solvents and cleaners, I got a waft of greasy hair, Coca-Cola, bubblegum and chocolate. I whispered into her ear, "Where is it? Just point." I shone the torch all around the walls, and she pointed at the skirting board behind the door. This was good shit. Nothing seemed to have been disturbed. I immediately started prising the wooden strip away from the wall with a screwdriver. A vehicle passed the house, and I heard laughter from the police car, probably at control's expense. They'd be there solely to deter people from coming round and being nosy. Chances were the place would be pulled down soon. Who'd want to buy a house a family had been murdered in? Maybe it would be turned into a memorial park or something. I kept Kelly right next to me. I wanted to keep her reassured. She was interested in what was happening, and I smiled at her now and again to show that everything was fine. With a small creak, the section of board started to give way. I pulled it right off and put it to one side. Then I bent down again and shone the torch inside. The beam glinted on metal. What looked like a gun safety box, about 18 inches square, was recessed into the wall. The lock was a lever, very similar to a UK Chubb. It was going to need decoding. It could take hours. I got out the black wallet and set to work, trying to remember to grin at her and let her know it wouldn't be long. But I could see she was getting restless. 10 minutes went by. 15, 20. Finally, it was all too much for her. In a loud whisper, she said crossly,
"What about my teddies?"
"Shh." I put my finger to her lips.
"The police."
What I meant was, "Fuck the teddies. We'll get them when I'm ready." I carried on decoding. There was a pause then, no longer a whisper.
"But you said..."
It had to be cut. Obviously, being Mr. Smiley wasn't working. I turned on her and hissed,
"We'll do it in a minute. Now shut up."
She was taken aback, but it worked. I was luckier than I might have been with the decoding. I'd just finished, had put the tools away and was opening the box, when I heard a low moan from her.
I don't like it here, Nick. It's all changed.
I turned round, grabbed her and covered her mouth with my hand.
For fuck's sake, shut up.
It wasn't what she expected, but I didn't have time to explain. With my hand still clamped hard over her mouth, I picked her up and slowly walked over to the window. I listened, waited, but there was nothing. Just a bit of banter and laughing, and the crackle of their radio. As I turned back, however, there was a short, sharp, metallic dragging sound. Then, for a split second, nothing. Then, as Kev's pewter tankard of pens and pencils fell from the desk and hit the bare flooring, there was a resounding crash. The noise went on as bits and pieces scattered in all directions. As I'd turned, Kelly's coats must have caught on the sharp points of the pencils and dragged the tankard off the table. I knew the noise was magnified 20 times in my head, but I also knew they would have heard it. Kelly chose that moment to start to lose it. But there was no time to worry about that. I just left her where she was, went to the doorway and listened to the sound of car doors opening and a sudden increase in radio traffic. Pulling the pistol from my jeans and checking chamber, I moved out of the study. 3 strides got me across the hall and into the kitchen. I closed the door behind me, took a couple of deep breaths and waited. The front door opened and I could hear both of them in the hallway. There was a click and light spilled under the kitchen door. Then, footsteps, and I could hear nervous breathing from the other side of the four-ply, and the jangle of keys on a belt. I heard the study door opening, then a half-shouted, half-whispered,
"Melvin! Melvin, in here!"
"Yo!"
I knew it was my time. I brought the pistol up into the fire position, put my hand on the doorknob and gently twisted. I moved into the hall. Melvin was in the study doorway, his back towards me. He was young and of medium build. I took a couple of big strides, grabbed him across the forehead with my left hand, yanked his head back, and rammed the pistol muzzle into his neck. In a very controlled voice that had nothing to do with the way I was feeling, I said,
"Drop your weapon, Melvin. Don't fuck me about. Drop it now."
Melvin's arm came down to his side, and he let the pistol fall to the floor. I couldn't see whether or not the other one had his pistol out. It was still dark in the study. Their torchlight was no help. Melvin and I blocked out most of the hallway light. I was hoping that he'd already reholstered, because part of their training would be not to scare kids. As far as he was concerned, it was just a kid there on her own. I shouted,
"Put the lights on, Kelly. Do it now."
Nothing happened.
"Kelly, turn the lights on."
I heard small footsteps coming towards us. There was a click and the lights came on.
"Now wait there."
I could see her eyes were swollen and red. Inside the room stood Michelin Man. He must have weighed 15 stones and, by the looks of the boy, he had only a couple of years to go before retirement. He was holstered, but his hand was down by his pistol.
I said, "Don't do it. Tell him, Melvin."
I prodded his neck.
Melvin went, "I'm fucked, Ron."
"Ron, don't start messing about. This is not the one to do it for. It's not worth it. Not just for this." I could see that Ron was quite switched on. He was thinking about his wife, his mortgage, and the chances of ever seeing another bag of donuts. Melvin's radio sparked up. Control snapped.
"Unit 62, Unit 62, do you copy?"
It sounded like a demand, not a request. It must have been great to be married to her.
"That's you, isn't it, Melvin?" I said.
"Yes, sir, that's us."
"Melvin, tell them you're okay."
I jabbed the pistol a little harder into his neck to underline the point. The safety catch is off, Melvin. I've got my finger on the trigger. Just tell them everything's okay. It ain't worth it, mate. Ron blurted,
I'll do it.
Another demand.
Unit 62, respond.
I said, put your right hand up and answer with your left. Kelly, be very quiet, okay? She nodded. Ron pressed his radio.
Hello, Control. We've checked. Everything's fine.
Roger, Unit 62, your report time to 22:13.
Ron clicked off. Kelly immediately went back into crying mode and sank to the floor. I was stuck in the doorway with a pistol to Melvin's neck. And Ron, who still had a weapon in his holster, was facing me from the middle of the room. At the end of the day, Ron, if you don't play the game, Melvin's going to die. And then you're going to die. Do you understand me? Ron nodded.
Okay, Ron. Let's see you turn round.
He did.
Get on your knees.
He did. He was about 4 feet from Kelly, but as long as she stayed still, she wasn't in the line of fire. Melvin was sweating good style. My hand was slipping on his forehead. There were even droplets running down the top slide. His shirt was so wet, I could make out the shape of his body armor underneath. I said, with your left hand, Ron, I want you to lift out your pistol, very slow, and use just your thumb and forefinger. Then, I want you to move it to your left-hand side and drop it. Do you understand me, Ron? Ron nodded.
I said, tell him, Melvin. Tell him not to fuck about.
Don't fuck around, Ron.
Ron gently removed his pistol from its holster and dropped it on the floor.
What I want you to do now, with your left hand, is get hold of your handcuffs. And I want you to drop them just behind you, understand?
Ron complied. I turned my attention to Melvin, who was starting to tremble. I spoke quietly in his ear.
Don't worry about it. You're going to live. You'll be talking to your grandchildren about this. Just do exactly what I say, understand?
He nodded. I turned to Ron and said, Now lie down, Ron. Face down on the floor. Ron spread-eagled himself and was now under control. I said, What I'm going to do next, Melvin, is take one step back, and this pistol is going to leave your neck. But it's still going to be pointing at your head, so don't get any ideas. Once I've stepped back, I'm then going to tell you to kneel down. Do you understand me? He nodded, and I took a swift step backwards. I wanted to be out of arm's length from him straight away. I didn't want him doing some kind of heroic pirouette to grab the pistol and knock it out of the way. Okay, now kneel down, then lie down, just like Ron. Now put your hand next to Ron. I now had both of them lying face down, forearms together. I moved behind them, picked up the handcuffs, and, with the pistol stuck in Melvin's ear, I locked his left wrist to Ron's right. I then took Melvin's handcuffs from their holster, stepped back and said, I want you to arch your bodies and move your free hands round so they're together as well. Both understand me? Believe me, boys, I want to get this over and done with. I just want out of here. I finished the job. At last, they were both totally under control. I took their wallets and threw them into the bag. I took Melvin's radio and kept it with me. And I took the battery out of Ron's and threw it into the bag. At the same time, I took out the roll of gaffer tape. I started with their legs, then used it to bind their heads together as well. I put a final strip around their necks and another around their mouths. I checked that both were breathing through their noses, then dragged them into the hallway. No small job. But I didn't want them to see what I was going to do next. I looked at Kelly, pressed against the study wall. She looked pathetic. This must have been terrible for her. She'd been looking forward so much to coming home, only to find it wasn't the place she'd been expecting. It wasn't only her family that was missing. Everything that was familiar to her was drenched in chemicals, shoved to one side or simply not there. I heard myself saying, "Go and see if your teddies are there." She turned and ran, and I heard her rattling up the now uncarpeted stairs. I went into the study, crouched down by the skirting board, and, at last, was able to open the gun box. There was nothing inside but a lone, floppy disk. I put the chair back by the desk and lifted up the PC. I soon had it working. There was no password protection, probably deliberately. If anything happened to Kev, he'd want the whole world to read what was on it. I clicked various files, but found nothing interesting. Then I found a file called Flavius, and I knew I'd hit pay dirt. It was the code name of the Gibraltar operation. I started reading. Kev had found out, much the same as Big Al had told me, that Pyra's connection with the cartels originated when they started running drugs for the Colombians up through North Africa and into Gibraltar, for distribution in Spain and the rest of Europe. Pyra were good at the job, and the cartels paid well. After a while, Pyra had also begun to use the drugs trade to gear up some of their own money, funds collected by NORAD in the USA. Big sums were involved. Kev's figures showed that Sinn Féin had been netting more than £500,000 a year. These donations had been invested in narcotics, transported to Europe, and then bartered for arms and explosives in the old Eastern Bloc countries. It was a business marriage made in heaven. Pyra had the drugs, the East had the weapons. The downfall of the USSR and the rise of the Russian mafia couldn't have been better timed. I had to get back into work mode. I couldn't just sit here reading. I was in a house with two policemen and one pissed-off little girl. I ejected the floppy disk and put it in my coat pocket. The controller from hell came back on the net.
Unit 62, do you copy?
Shit. I went into the hall. Ron, time to speak up. Ron looked at me, and I knew he was going to fuck me off. His face was a picture of defiance. I moved over to them and pulled the tape off their mouths. Ron was the first to talk.
You answer it, because we can't. You won't kill us, not for that.
Control went up an octave.
Unit 62!
Ron had a point. Kelly? Kelly, where are you?
Coming. Just found Ricky.
I stepped back over my two new friends towards Kelly coming down the stairs. There was no time to be sympathetic or nice. Get your coat and shoes on, quick. I got all the kit together, put on my trainers and checked Ron and Melvin weren't choking to death on the gaffer tape. Both looked quite happy with themselves, but still thinking of a good excuse for why they were in this state in the first place. We left the same way we'd come. I was gripping her hand, more or less dragging her along and keeping an eagle eye on Jenny and Ricky. I didn't want the neighbours hearing screams for lost teddies. As we drove, bursts of light from the street lamps strobed into the back of the car and I could see her in the rearview mirror. She was looking miserable, her eyes puffy and wet. She had every right to be sad. She was bright enough to realise that this was probably the last time she'd be here. This wasn't her home anymore. Now she was the same as me. Neither of us had one. I saw the signs for Dulles Airport and pushed my foot down. I was not going to take the risk of driving back to Florida. Chapter 35. I hit the airport approach road and headed for economy parking. I allowed myself a wry smile. If this carried on, it would soon be full of my stolen cars. I got one or two spots of rain on my arm as I took a ticket from the machine, and by the time we'd parked, there was a light patter on the roof. Ron and Melvin might have made a connection between me and the car because of the drive past. They might have been rescued and circulated the registration. There was not a lot I could do about that, but just sit tight and hope that the mass of cars and the rain would conceal us, because it was far too early for a child to be moving around an airport with an adult man with scabs on his face. I turned round in the seat and said, "Are you all right, Kelly? I'm sorry I had to shout. But sometimes adults have to be really firm with kids. She was looking down at one of the teddies, picking the fur, pouting. I said, you're not a bad girl, and I'm sorry that I told you off. I didn't really mean it. I was just getting all excited. She nodded slowly, still playing with her furry friend. Do you want to come to England? She looked up. She didn't say anything, but I took it as a yes. That's good, because I would like you to come too. You've been a really good girl. You always do what I say. Do you want to help me again? She shrugged. I leaned over and picked up the other teddy and rubbed its face against her cheek. We'll get Jenny and Ricky to help me as well. How about that? She gave a reluctant nod. First of all, we've got to sort out the bag. I got into the back seat and put the hold all between us, opening it up. What do you think we should take out, then? I knew exactly what we were going to take out, everything apart from the blanket and washing kit, because they were the only things I needed now. I said, what do you reckon? Is that all? She nodded and agreed, as if she'd packed it herself. Everything I was not going to take I put into the boot. The rain was now coming down more heavily. I sat with her again and pulled out the blanket. We have to wait here for the next couple of hours. It's too early to go to the airport yet. You can have a sleep if you like. I folded up the bag and made a pillow. There, that's better. Cuddle Jenny and Ricky. She looked at me and smiled. We were mates again. You aren't going away again, are you, Nick? For once, I told the truth. No, I'm going to do some work. You just go to sleep. I'm not going anywhere. I got out and sat in the front again. I rested the laptop on my knees and lifted the screen. I checked that the keys were in the ignition and I could easily grab the steering wheel. I had to be ready to move at once if we got pinged. I pressed the on switch, and as the screen lit up, it cast a glow inside the car. I inserted Kev's floppy disk. I was desperate to read the rest of his report, but first, as an extra backup, I downloaded everything onto the laptop. As I waited, I said quietly, Kelly? There was no reply. The gentle rhythm of the rain had done its job. I began reading where I'd left off. I knew that Gibraltar had always been a center for international drug trafficking, money laundering, and smuggling. But it seemed that, in 1987, Spain not only still wanted Gib back, it also wanted the Brits to crack down on drug trafficking as well. Thatcher's government told the Gibraltarians to sort it out. But the high-powered speedboats still ran drugs over from North Africa. The Brits threatened direct control of the colony if the trafficking didn't stop, and, at the same time, ordered a highly illegal operation against police and government officials they suspected of involvement. The boys taking the backhanders got the hint and suddenly stopped cooperating with Pyra and everyone else. My eyes were racing ahead of my brain. The closure of the Gibraltar route was all well and good for the war against corruption, but the Colombians were very pissed off. A major trade artery had been clamped off, and they wanted it reopened. According to Kev's findings, they decided a show of strength was required. They wanted Gibraltar bombed as a warning that the officials should start cooperating again, and they ordered Pyra to carry it out. Pyra had a problem with this. They wanted the route reopened as much as the Colombians did. But after the debacle of Enniskillen, they couldn't run the risk of killing non-UK civilians and invoking even greater international condemnation. They'd refused to do it. From evidence that Kev had gathered, the cartel's reply to Pyra was blunt. Either you bomb Gibraltar, or we shift our drugs business to the Protestant UVF. For Pyra, not a good day out. Pyra's head shed came up with a solution, and, as I read on, I couldn't help but admire it. Mad Danny McCann had already been kicked out of Pyra and reinstated against Jerry Adams's wishes. Mairead Farrell, after the death of her boyfriend, had become too fanatical for her own good. a bit of a social hand grenade, Simmons had said of her. Pyra's plan was to send to Gibraltar two players they'd be happy to see the back of, together with Sean Savage, who just had the misfortune to be part of the same ASU. The team were issued with the technology and Semtex for the bomb, but were told it was to stay behind in Spain until they had done their recces and rehearsals. They were told only to take it in once the blocking car was in position, to guarantee the correct placement of the bomb. Pyra then gave the three players bad passports and leaked information to London. They wanted the Brits to react and stop the bombing so that, when the three were arrested, they could claim to the cartels that they'd given it their best shot. We'd duly been told about the ASU, but, as I remembered, we'd also been briefed that there would be no blocking car, and that the bomb would be detonated by a handheld device. These last two pieces of intelligence meant that McCann, Farrell and Savage had never stood a chance. They were dead from the moment we thought the bomb was in position and armed, because one of them was bound to make a hand movement at some stage that would be construed as an attempt to detonate the device. I certainly wouldn't have taken the chance that Savage was only going for his packet of mints. And Ewan obviously didn't when he initiated the contact with McCann and Farrell. In Pat's immortal words, better to be tried by 12 than carried by 6. A dialogue box came up on the screen telling me that I was running short of power and needed to plug into another power source. Fuck. I wanted to read more. I got back to the screen and read as fast as I could to get the drift. Even though there hadn't been a bomb, the cartels had accepted that their Irish lackeys were playing ball. After all, three of their people had been killed in the process. Pyra kept the trade with the Colombians, even though, as Big Al had said, it was thereafter routed through South Africa and Spain. Pyra were in raptures. They'd got rid of two troublemakers, not quite in the way that they'd intended. But three martyrs had been created, with the result that their cause at home was strengthened. And even more dollars rolled into the coffers from the Irish Americans. It was only the Brits who appeared to have been left with egg on their faces. But even so, no matter how much the international community publicly condemned the shootings, in secret, most heads of state admired Thatcher's muscular stand against terrorism. Fuck it. Another box came up and told me to plug into an external power source. I switched the laptop off and packed it away, full of frustration. I wanted to know more. At the same time, I was on a high. If we made it back to the UK with this stuff, I'd have cracked it with Simmons. It was 3:30 a.m. There was nothing to do but wait for the next couple of hours or so until the first wave of aircraft started to arrive and depart, creating enough activity for a man with a scabby face and a 7-year-old in tow to blend in. I let the backrest down a bit and tried to get my neck into a comfortable position. But I couldn't relax. My mind was racing. The whole operation in Gibraltar had been a setup so that Pyra and the Colombians could keep making money. Fair one, but where did Kev and I fit into the scheme of things? I lay there and listened to the beat of rain on the roof. For Ewan and me, it had all started on the 3rd of March, less than a week before the shootings. We were both on different jobs over the water and had got lifted off and sent to Lisbon, HQ of the British Army in Northern Ireland. From there, it was a quick move by Puma to Stirling Lines in Hereford, England, the home of the Special Air Service. One of the slime was waiting to take us straight to RHQ. And the moment I saw the china cups and biscuits outside the briefing room, I knew that something big was in the offing. Last time that had happened, the Prime Minister had been here. The room was in semi-darkness and packed. There was a large screen at the back of a stage and tiered seats so that everyone got a good view. We were looking for somewhere to sit when I heard, "Oi, over here, dick spot." Kev and Slack Pat were sitting drinking tea. With them were the other two members of their four-man team, Jeff and Steve. All were from A Squadron, and were doing their 6 months on the counter-terrorist team. Ewan turned to Kev and said,
Know what this job is about?
We're off to Jib, mate. Pyra's planning a bomb. The CO got up on the stage and the room fell silent.
Two problems, he said. Number one, a shortage of time. You leave immediately after this briefing. Number two, shortage of solid intelligence. However, Joint Operations Committee wants the regiment to deploy. You will get as much intelligence as we know now. And as it comes in during your flight and once on the ground.
I thought, what the fuck are Ewan and I doing here? Surely, as debt operators, it would be illegal for us to work outside Northern Ireland. I kept my mouth shut. If I started querying the decision, they might send me back and I'd miss out. I looked around me and saw members of RHQ, the operations officer and the world supply of INT Corps. The final member of the team was an ammunitions technical officer, a bomb disposal expert on attachment to the CT team. Someone I had never seen before moved towards the stage, a teacup in one hand, biscuits in the other. He stood to the right-hand side of the stage by the lectern. There was an overnight bag by his feet.
My name is Simmons, and I run the Northern Ireland desk for the intelligence service from London. The people behind you are a mix of service and military intelligence officers. First, a very brief outline of the events that have brought us all here today.
Judging by the bag, it looked as if he would be coming with us. The lights were dimmed, and a slide projector lit the screen behind him.
Last year, he said, we learned that a Pyra team had based itself in southern Spain. We intercepted mail going to the homes of known players from Spain and found a postcard from Sean Savage in the Costa del Sol.
A slide of the player came up on the screen.
Our Sean, Simmons said with a half smile, told Mummy and Daddy he was working abroad. It rang a few alarm bells when we read it, because the work young Savage is best at is bomb making.
Was he making a funny?
No, he didn't look the sort. Then, in November, two men went through Madrid airport on their way from Malaga to Dublin. They carried Irish passports, and in a routine check the Spanish sent the details to Madrid, who, in turn, passed them with photographs to London. It turned out that both passports were false.
I thought to myself, stupid timing by them, really. Terrorist incidents in Northern Ireland tended to decrease in the summer months, when Pyra took their wives and kids to Torremolinos for a fortnight of sun and sand. The funny thing was that the RUC also took their holidays in the same places, and they'd all bump into each other in the bars. By travelling to Spain out of the tourist season, these two characters had drawn attention to themselves. If they'd passed through Malaga Airport during the holiday season, they might have got away with it. It turned out that one of the passport holders was Sean Savage, but it was the identity of the second man that had got everybody flapping. Simmons showed his next slide.
Daniel Martin McCann. I'm sure you know more about him than I do.
He gave a no-fucking-way sort of smile.
Mad Danny had really earned his name. Linked to 26 killings, he had been lifted often, but had only been put away for 2 years.
To the firm, Simmons went on, the combination of McCann and Savage on the Costa del Sol could only mean one of two things. Either Pyra was going to attack a British target on the Spanish mainland, or there was going to be an attack on Gibraltar.
One thing was for sure, Simmons said. They weren't there to top up their tans.
At last, there was a round of laughter. I could see Simmons liked that, as if he'd practiced his one-liner so the timing was just right. Despite that, I was warming to the man. It wasn't often that you got people making jokes at a briefing as important as this one. The slide changed again to a street map of Gibraltar. I was listening to him, but at the same time thinking of my infantry posting there in the 1970s. I'd had a whale of a time. Gibraltar is a soft target, Simmons said. There are several potential locations for a bomb, such as the governor's residence or the law courts. But our threat assessment is that the most likely will be the garrison regiment, the Royal Anglians. Every Tuesday morning, the band of the 1st Battalion parade for the changing of the guard ceremony. We think the most likely site for a bomb is the square that the band march into after the parade. A bomb could easily be concealed in a car there. He might have added that, from a bomber's point of view, it would be a near-perfect location. Because of the confined area, the blast would be tamped, and therefore more effective. Following this assessment, we stopped the ceremony on the 11th of December. The local media reported that the governor's guardhouse needed urgent redecoration. In fact, we needed time while we gathered more intelligence to stop it needing rebuilding. Not as good as his last one, but there were still a few subdued laughs. The local police were then reinforced by plainclothes officers from the UK, and the surveillance paid off. When the ceremony resumed on the 23rd of February, a woman, ostensibly holidaying on the Costa del Sol, made a trip to the Rock and photographed the parade. She was covertly checked and was found to be travelling on a stolen Irish passport. The following week she was there again, only this time she tagged along behind the bandsmen as they marched to the square. Even one of the Rock apes could have worked out that she was recceing for the arrival of an active service unit. There was loud laughter. He'd done it again. I wasn't too sure if we were all laughing at his jokes, or just at the fact that he kept on telling them. Who the fuck was this man? This should have been one of the most serious briefings ever. Either he just didn't give a fuck, or he was so powerful no one was going to say a word against him. Whatever. I could already tell his presence in Gibraltar would be a real bonus. Simmons stopped smiling. Our intelligence tells us that the bombing is to take place sometime this week. However, there is no sign that either McCann or Savage is getting ready to leave Belfast. He wasn't wrong. I'd seen both of them, pissed as farts, outside a bar in the Falls Road just the night before. They didn't look that ready to me. It should take them quite a while to prepare for this one, or maybe this was part of the preparation, having their last night out before work started. This is where we have a few problems, he went on. He was working now without his notes. Did that mean no more one-liners? Certainly there was more of an edge to his voice. What are we to do with these people? If we try to move in on them too early, that would leave other pirate teams free to go ahead with the bombing. In any case, if the ASU travel through Malaga Airport and remain on Spanish territory until the last minute, there is no guarantee that the Spanish will hand them over. Not only because of the dispute with the UK on the question of Gibraltar, but also because the case against them could only be based on conspiracy, which is pretty flimsy. So, gentlemen, we must arrest them in Gibraltar. The screen went blank, and there was only the light from the lectern shining up on his face. And this throws up three options. The first is to arrest them as they cross the border from Spain. Easier said than done. There's no guarantee we'll know what kind of vehicle they're in. There would be only about 10 to 15 seconds in which to make a positive identification and effect an arrest. Not an easy thing to do, especially if they're sitting in a car and probably armed. The second option is to arrest the team once they're in the area of the square. But again, this depends on advance warning and positive identification, and they're all being together with the device. At the present time, therefore, we are going for the third option. And that's why we are all here. He took a sip of his tea and asked for the lights to come on. The security service will place surveillance teams to trigger the pirate team into Gibraltar. He looked around for each group as he talked. The two soldiers, who have just arrived from the province, must give positive IDs before the civil authorities will hand over the operation to the military. The four men from your counter-terrorist team
will go for an arrest, but only after they have planted the device. The two soldiers who have just arrived from the province. Now I understood. That was Ewan and me.
Once arrested, Simmons went on, they are to be handed over to the civil authorities. Of course, the normal protection will be given to the team from any court appearance. The two operators from the province will not, repeat not, conduct any arrest or contact action. You understand the reasons why. He managed to smile. I think that's enough, gentlemen. He looked at Frank, the CO. Francis, I understand we fly to RAF Lynham in 10 minutes, to link up with the Hercules. Just over 3 hours later, I was sitting in a C-130 with Ewan, who was busy worrying about a black mark on his new trainers. Kev was checking the weapon bundles and ammunition and, more importantly, as far as I was concerned, the medical packs. If I got dropped, I wanted fluid put into me as soon as possible. We landed at about 11:30 p.m. on Thursday the 3rd of March. The whole rock was still awake. Lights were on everywhere. We moved off to the military area where trucks were waiting with our advance party to get us away quickly and without fuss. Our FOB was in HMS Rook, the Royal Navy Shore Base. We had requisitioned half a dozen rooms in the accommodation block and turned them into living space, with our own cooking area and ops room. Wires trailed everywhere. Telephones were ringing. Scalies ran around in tracksuits or jeans, testing radios and SATCOM links. Over the din, Simmons said, Int suggests there could be a third member of the team, and probably its commander. Her name is Mairead Farrell. Pictures will be here within the hour, but here's some background for you. She's a particularly nasty piece of work. He paused to time his delivery to perfection. Middle class, 31, ex-convent schoolgirl. When the laughter died down, he told us more about her. She'd served 10 years in prison for planting a bomb in the Conway Hotel, Belfast, in 1976. But as soon as she was released, she reported straight back to Pyra for duty. There was a slight smile on his face as he explained that her lover, unbelievably named Brendan Burns, had blown himself up recently. The meeting broke, and we mooched around looking for a brew. A scaly came over and handed out street maps. They've already been spotted up by the firm, he said. As we started to look at their handiwork, he carried on. The main routes from the border to the square are marked in detail. The rest of the town fairly well, and of the outlying areas, just major points. I looked at it. Fucking hell. There were about 100 coordinates to learn before the ASU came over the border. I didn't know which was tougher, the pirate team or the homework. Any questions, lads? Kev said, Yeah, three. Where do we sleep, where's the bog, and is there a brew on? In the morning, we picked up our weapons and ammunition and went onto the range. The four on the CT team had their own pistols. The ones we had were borrowed. Our own was still in Derry. Not that it mattered that much. People think that blokes in the regiment are very particular about their weapons, but they aren't. So long as you know that when you pull the trigger, it fires first time and the rounds will hit the target you're aiming at, you're happy. Once at the range, people did their own thing. The other four just wanted to know that their mags were working okay and that the pistols had no defects after being bundled up. Ewan and I wanted to do the same, but also to find out the behaviour of our new weapons at different ranges. After firing off all the mags in quick succession to make sure everything worked, we then fired at 5, 10, 15, 20 and 25 metres. Good, slow, aimed shots, always aiming at the same point and checking where the rounds fell at each range. That way we found out where to aim at 15 metres, for example. And that was at the top of the target's torso. Because of the distance, quite a lot for a pistol, the rounds would fall lower into the bottom of his chest and take him down. Every weapon is different, so it took an hour to be confident. Once finished, we didn't strip the weapons to clean them. Why do that when we knew they worked perfectly? We just got a brush into the area that feeds the round into the barrel and got the carbon off. Next job was getting on the ground to learn the SPOTS system. At the same time, checking our radios and finding out if there were any dead areas. We were still running around doing that when, at 2 p.m, Alpha came up on the net. Hello, all stations. Return to this location immediately. Simmons was already in the briefing area, looking like a man under pressure. Like the rest of us, he'd probably had very little sleep. There was 2 days' growth on his chin, and he was having a bad hair day. Something was definitely on. There was a lot more noise and bustle from the machines and men in the background. He had about 20 bits of paper in his hands. The slime were giving him more as he talked, as well as distributing copies of the rules of engagement to us. The operation, I saw, was now called Flavius. Just about an hour and a half ago, he said, Savage and McCann passed through immigration at Malaga Airport. They were on a flight from Paris. Farrell met them. We have no idea how she got there. The team is complete. There is just one little problem. The Spaniards lost them as they got into a taxi. Triggers are now being placed on the border crossing as a precaution. I have no reason to believe that the attack will not take place as planned. He paused and looked at each of us in turn. I've just become aware of two very critical pieces of information. First, the players will not be using a blocking car to reserve a parking space in the target area. A blocking car would mean making 2 trips across the border, and the int is that they're not prepared to take the risk. The Pyra vehicle, when it arrives, should therefore be perceived as the real thing. Second, the detonation of the bomb will be by a handheld remote control initiation device. They want to be sure that the bomb goes off at exactly the right moment. Remember, gentlemen, any one of the team, or all of them, could be in possession of that device. That bomb must not detonate. There could be hundreds of lives at risk. I was woken by the noise of engines in reverse and wheels on tarmac. It was just after 6 a.m. I had been asleep for 3 hours. It was still dark, and the rain had eased quite a bit. I leaned over to the back. Kelly. Kelly, time to wake up. As I shook her, there was a gentle moan.
Oh, okay. I'm coming.
She sat up, rubbing her eyes. With the cuff of my coat, I started to tidy her up. I didn't want her walking into the airport looking wrecked. I wanted us looking as spruce and happy as Marie and Donny Osmond on Prozac. We got out of the car with the bag, and I looked up, after checking inside to make sure there wasn't anything attractive on view. The last thing I needed now was a car park attendant taking an interest in my lock-picking kit. We walked over to the stop and didn't have long to wait before the bus arrived to take us to departures. The terminal looked just like any airport at that time of the morning. The check-in desks were already quite busy with business flyers. Some people, mostly student types, looked as though they were waiting for flights that they'd got there much too early for, and had got their heads down in sleeping bags spread across 3 or 4 seats, with a massive backpack alongside. Cleaners with polishing machines trudged across the tiled floors like zombies. I picked up a free airport magazine from the rack at the top of the escalator. Looking at the flight guide at the back, I saw that the first possible departure to the UK was at just after 5 p.m. that evening. It was going to be a long wait. I looked at Kelly. We both could do with a decent wash. We went down the escalator to the international arrivals area on the lower level. I put some money in a machine and bought a couple of travel kits to supplement our washing gear and went into one of the disabled toilets. I shaved as Kelly washed her face. I scraped the dirt off her boots with toilet paper and generally cleaned her up, combed her hair, and put it in an elastic band at the back so it didn't look so greasy.